HPPodCraft.com.
Solitary and forbidding, the house stared specter-like through the scraggly trees that seemed to shrink from its touch. The green moss of decay lay on its dank roofs, and the windows set in deep cavities peered blindly at the world as if through eyeless sockets. So forbidding was its aspect that boys, on approaching its cheerless gables, stopped their whistling and passed on the opposite side of the street.
Who's got a spooky house? We do!
A spooky house that is so spooky that it inhibits whistling, and its windows are intact, which it's a surprise they have survived in view of the known habits of small boys the world over. Name the Lovecraft story.
The Unnameable?
The Haunter of the Dark. Ugh.
Oh, damn it.
How far we've fallen.
Man, well, what's it been? 10 years since we finished Lovecraft?
It has been. It's been quite a while.
But this week, we're rocking a twofer. That's two Farnsworth Wright stories for the one low episode.
What are you getting at?
That's not right.
That doesn't work. Well, if you are horrified by one Farnsworth Wright story, what do you say to too many usages of this joke? Not going to do it anymore. While we were covering the story Ooze, which was in the first issue of Weird Tales, I saw that Mr. Wright had a story in there as well. And since he was the editor for Lovecraft and Howard and all these folks, mm-hmm. we speak of him very often on the show.
Yeah.
And I thought we'd cover some of his actual fiction, see what he's all about when he's writing.
Yeah.
Hey, who is that reader?
Why, that's the amazing Ryan Negron. He's a Chicago man who loves acting and all things sci-fi and fantasy. You might have seen him on stage in Chicago, New York, or Memphis, but never in my living room. You might think from the quality of this reading that he has done some voice work, and you would be correct.
Yes.
In video games like Eximius Sees the Front Line. But the thing he's really kicked ass on was some dubbing for anime. Pfeiffer, your old job.
All right.
You can hear him on Strike Witches, Road to Berlin, and Mars Red.
Cool. Well, he's also a fan of our show, so he has great taste. Thank you, Ryan, for reading for the show. We're definitely going to have him on again.
We're covering two stories, The Closing Hand and The Snake Fiend.
The Snake Fiend. These are from issue 1 and issue 2 of Weird Tales, respectively. And you know that The Closing Hand from issue 1 is going to be good because the subtitle of the story is A Powerful Short Story. I kind of thought that was up to the reader to determine, yeah. But mm-hmm. the editor is not screwing around on this issue. And you know what's funny is even when you look in the table of contents, the story is listed as The Closing Hand, and the synopsis is a brief story, powerfully written. So you're told it's powerful in two different ways.
Yeah.
Which raised an issue for me personally as I was thinking about it, because you know this, I exercise a lot of power here and there, you know, just when I'm doing things around the house, my daily life, I do a lot of things powerfully if I can.
Okay.
Should I have been warning people about this all the time? This is going to be a powerful car wash.
No, they get what they get.
Let's try a little harder at letting people know when power's on the way.
Okay.
Just try it. What do we know about Farnsworth Wright?
Well, this is going to be a very powerful biography, so become ready for that.
See, that was a perfect thing. You did it right there. It's a powerful biography. Now I know what to expect.
Mr. Wright was born in 1888 in California, went to University in Nevada and Washington, getting heavily into journalism. That was his bag. It said on Wikipedia he had a lot of personal tragedy in his early years that he didn't talk about. The one thing that they do mention is that his roommate at the University of Washington, John Rowan, was swimming with Farnsworth. John, great swimmer, and Farnsworth wasn't a great swimmer. They both got caught in some eddies while they were swimming near Westport, Washington. And ironically, it was John that drowned and died, and Farnsworth was rescued and he survived.
Oh, man.
And that's the one thing I guess he talked about, because nobody else, you know, all these other stories that he keeps to himself. Well, I mean, he was drafted into the army in 1917, so he served in the infantry in World War I, which is probably a whole other
couldn't have been good, yeah.
mess of stuff. After the war, Wright was a music critic for the Chicago Herald, but he did some manuscript reading for Weird Tales. He wrote some stories, but he came on as a full editor in 1924 for Weird Tales.
In 1924. By the way, in the 1920s, it's funny that it said he was a music critic. I don't know what that looked like in the 1920s, but you had popular songs where a musical saw was the lead instrument, like Whispering. You had the OK Laughing record, which was just two opera singers laughing for 3 minutes. I don't know if you've ever heard that, but it was a hit record, a million copies, just people laughing. People loved it. So it actually seems like the only decade that a music critic would be happy about would be the 1920s, because everything is weird and unexpected. If you were a Pitchfork writer in the 1920s, oh, every review would be great.
Now, I want to read this from Wikipedia here. I'm just going to quote. During Wright's editorship of Weird Tales, which lasted until 1940, the magazine regularly published the notable authors H.P. Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard, and Clark Ashton Smith. Yet Wright had a strained relationship with all three writers, rejecting major works by them, such as Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness and The Shadow over Innsmouth, Howard's The Frost Giant's Daughter, and Smith's The Seven Geasses, which Wright dismissed as just one geese after another.
It's geish, though. You laughed the last time I made the correction about the seven geish. Geishes. It's geish.
Geish? Whatever.
We got corrected for it, so I just want to show people that we're learning.
He could both be discouraging and encouraging with equal lack of logic. His preference for shorter fiction particularly led him to discourage Lovecraft's, whose best works emerged at longer lengths during the early 1930s. Nevertheless, as Mike Ashley has put it, Wright developed Weird Tales from a relatively routine pulp magazine to create what has become a legend. So poor old Wright, he developed Parkinson's in 1921. When he was doing Weird Tales, he already was suffering from the disease, and it ultimately took his life in 1940 at the age of 51.
That's very sad. And by the way, you said this was going to be a powerful biography at the top, which it was, but you did not warn me that it would be so powerfully told. So you only did 50% of the work there. Next time, a powerful biography, and by the way, it's going to be powerfully told. I was only half ready for that. My socks, I'm missing a sock now. Just a little warning next time. Let's dig into the story.
All right. Now, this first story is very, very short. It begins in a spooky house that people think is haunted. There are two sisters who at first I thought were children, but I think they're supposed to be older, maybe young adults. They're staying in this house alone, mostly to keep people from breaking in.
I dug this story, but what a failure at the top, because I didn't know why anybody was in the house. The girls in their conversation established that their parents left them there, apparently to stifle burglary.
Uh-huh.
I guess they just moved in and then the folks went back out to take care of other business.
I don't know.
Just one sentence that said there were boxes everywhere or something could have at least cleared this up for me, because It starts by telling you this house is haunted as f-. Cut to two girls are asleep and nobody's lived there for 2 years. Cut to two girls sleeping upstairs. I didn't get it. But let me ask you, maybe I was missing something, because when I think of home protection, I might have to leave. Somebody's going to take my valuables, especially if they're all boxed up and I just moved in. So maybe I'll get a sturdy lock, even a big dog.
Makes sense.
But do you guys ever, when you guys leave, do you ever go, hey, just leave the kids behind?
Yeah.
Like if a burglar breaks in, they can handle it.
Well, the kids, they scrabble around and then the burglar will think maybe there's giant rats inside. There's rabies and the Black Plague and all that stuff.
Oh, so you do that.
It works, too. We've never been burgled.
Then I thought, well, maybe that's why they even moved into this neighborhood. They were like, this is great. There's so many burglars, you don't even have to pay for a babysitter. There's an adult all around all the time with the burglar population here. Now it makes sense.
The older sister doesn't believe in hauntings, but the younger one, she does, even though she's trying to not let on. You know, she's trying to be cool with it, but she's actually really terrified of these ghosts.
Well, she says, don't talk about burglars. I'm afraid. I keep imagining I hear ghostly footsteps. I like that they throw burglar around a lot in here. It's making me laugh. The sister says, go to sleep, Goosey. Haunted houses are nothing but superstition. They exist only in imagination.
And the younger sister says, why has nobody lived here for 2 years then? They tell me that for 5 years, every family moved out after being here just a short time. The whole atmosphere of the house is ghastly. And I can't forget how the older Berkheim girl was found stabbed to death in her bed. And nobody ever knew how it happened. Why she may have been murdered in this very room.
I think Farnsworth was in his 30s. Did you say he was born in like...
88.
He's like Lovecraft's age, right? Yeah, so he was born around...
He's older than Lovecraft. Lovecraft was in 90.
Yeah, so he's like in his early... This really felt like one of Lovecraft's juvenilia stories or something. But I do like the setup, because this is what sent us off in these directions of loving horrors. Laying in bed as kids and being scared. Mm-hmm. But just the way that it was like, you know that for 2 years nobody lived here, and for 5 years previous to that, you know, she's got all this information in the dialogue. It's just really little kid writing.
Because obviously her sister would know all of these things already, and they don't to say them. The older sister tells her that she's off her nut and to just go to sleep. The older sister drifts off, but the younger one stays awake with fear. Then she hears a noise. She wakes the older sister and tells her someone or something is in the house. The older sister lights a candle and goes down to check it out.
She heads on down in her gown and slippers, and then the noise downstairs stops. The younger sister's laying there in the dark, The rain picks up outside.
10 minutes passed, 20 minutes, and Edith had not returned. The younger sister hears a door slam and someone moving around downstairs, then someone slowly coming up the stairs. And someone coming into her room. Now, it's hard to hear with all this wind and storm going on outside.
But it's a good old campfire story kind of creep. Between gusts, she heard the portentous sound, and each time it seemed nearer, nearer, and nearer the strange noise came. It passed the first landing, moved slowly to the second flight. And now the girl's pounding pulses drowned out the screaming of the wind, for the presence had invaded her bedroom.
Now she wonders if it's a ghost or a thing risen from the grave that's come to kill her. You know, there's a lot of different options here.
Yeah.
But she believes her sister is dead, and that because this thing has killed her sister and now it's come for her. Right. She gets out of bed, scrambles up against the wall, and the thing gets closer.
Slowly, the being dragged itself across the floor, lifted itself onto the bed, and uttered a choking sound of agony. The girl sat petrified. Then, timorously, she extended a shaky hand, but quickly withdrew it in dread of some hideous contact. Again, she thrust her trembling hand into the gloom, farther, farther, until it touched something shaggy and wet. A clammy hand closed over hers, and she started to her feet with a horrified scream. The icy hand tightened with a sickening tremor and dragged her down. Then her tortured senses gave way, and she fell back unconscious upon the bed. When she awoke, it was day. Beside her on the bed lay the bleeding body of her sister, Edith, stabbed in the breast by the burglar she had tried to frighten away. The younger girl was clutching the clotted wisps of hair that had fallen across the breast of her sister, whose cold hand had closed over her in the last convulsive shudder of death.
Whoa.
So, there's no twist, really. They thought it was a burglar, and then one girl says it might be a ghost, but it was just a burglar.
Pretty hilarious.
Is that a twist? We're supposed to think that it was going to be a ghost, but then it actually does turn out. So it's like a double twist? Is that what was supposed to happen?
Well, it is a double twist the way you explained it, because I didn't even think about a ghost. I mean, what I think he's trying to get at is she reached out a hand and she felt, because it says she felt a clump of hair. So I think the idea was she thought, it's a hairy monster. And then it was like, oh, wait, no, silly. It's just your murdered sister. because she's got the hair in her hand when they find her. So
yeah.
It's a switcheroo. It's supposed to be a twist, but it's just one horrible thing instead of another horrible thing.
Yeah.
You know, something like this would work, say, in Prison with the Pharaohs, when it's like, I saw a monster. That's not a monster. That's the finger on the real monster's hand. There's a revelation that comes with it. It's not, I saw a monster. No, you didn't. You saw a demon. Like, what? It's the same. I was stabbed by a chef's knife. No. Looks like an ice pick. And it's weakened even further because you mentioned this. The protagonist isn't even convinced it's a ghost or a monster or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It actually says in the narrative, or was it a murderer?
Yeah.
Who, having killed her sister, was now bent on completing his bloody work. So she ideated that it was exactly what it turned out to be.
Yeah.
So I think he was trying to go for, she felt like it was a monster. It turned out this thing wasn't, that it was this burglar. Maybe it's a spin on the urban legend of the, aren't you glad I didn't turn on the light? You know that one? Which I always heard as a newer one. It's kind of like the chloroform story. You hear it in the dorms, where it was, I'm grabbing this from Snopes. Here's the short explanation.
Okay,
it's a girl studying late, goes back to her dorm room to get some books or notes. Didn't want to disturb her roommate, so she doesn't turn on the lights. She gets her stuff off of her desk. Later, when she goes back to the room, her roommate's murdered. Uh-huh. And there's a note written in lipstick on the mirror that says, aren't you glad you didn't turn on the light?
Oh, no, because the murderer was in the room when she came in to get the books. Yeah. Oh, that's a good one.
That's a pretty good one. There's another variation of it that's got a little bit of a twist on the punchline, which is there's a woman who's alone in her apartment. She goes to bed with her dog on the floor beside her. Middle of the night, she's woken up by a strange sound. She's alarmed. She reaches down to the dog, who licks her hand. She's reassured, goes back to sleep. In the morning, she finds the dog hung in the shower, dead.
Uh-huh.
Where the dog slept, she picks up a note that reads, humans can lick too.
Oh, God. I've never heard that one before.
Yeah. So that wasn't the dog that licked her hand.
No.
So I wondered, was this story something that would have been around at the time? Turns out the licked hand motif shows up. Here's an August 1871 diary entry.
Okay, okay.
Penned in England by one Dearman Birchall. Croquet party. One of the guests told of a clergyman who was aroused in the middle of the night by his wife, who said, "John, dear, I am sure there is a robber under the bed. I hear him moving. Do get up and see." And John replied, "Oh, it's only the Newfoundland dog. I just put my hand out and he licked it." Next morning, all the jewelry and many other effects had disappeared.
Wow.
Now, that's actually the best telling of the story because it left the punchline for you to figure out.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. That wasn't the dog who licked him. Again, that diary entry, a better execution of that than this story by Farnsworth.
Yeah.
But switcheroos seem to be a motif for Wright, as we'll find in the next story.
Yes, we get this one. Farnsworth Wright offers another tale of diabolic terror, the Snake Fiend.
Even as a child, Jack Crimey delighted in collecting reptiles, and he seemed to absorb much of their venomous nature. His best-loved pet was a large black snake, but when it cost him a whipping by crawling into his father's bedroom, he roasted it over a slow fire in a large pot, listening with glee to its agonized hissing and pushing it back with a stick when it strove to crawl out of the searing container. It's no cause for wonder, then, that his burning love for the girl of his dreams turned into a fierce hate when she became the bride of another.
Ah, God, that's gruesome.
Yeah.
I'm not into snakes, but geez, roasting it alive?
Yeah, I don't even though I like lobster, when I see them cooking them alive like that, I go, yeah, that's pretty rough. I did throw a snake into traffic once.
What?
There was a snake that was freaking out two of my friends, and to show that I wasn't freaked out, I picked the snake up, and then I was immediately freaked out, and so I threw it, and it went into the road, and a car hit it immediately.
Oh, right, God.
Under the wheel. So I did murder a snake by that.
Jesus.
But I didn't watch it boil alive. I mean,
no.
I guess I'm a snake murderer either way.
And that'll never change.
I'm sorry. You know what? That was a really powerful anecdote. I should have warned you about that.
You should have warned me. Sorry. So we have this spurned psychopath, Jack Crimey, who's really into snakes. A woman that he's known since youth, Marjorie, that he's really been into, but never told her or gave her any indication that he liked her. She found love with another guy, this dude, Alan Jimerson. A nice enough guy.
Yeah, I just am realizing that Jack Crimey, what's in a name, right? That might tip the hand a little bit that he's a criminal. God. This is a really very real setup, though, that I thought was a little more complicated than your normal juvenilia. You know, someone acting out of revenge for something that happened entirely in their mind. And there's also some psychology in his attraction to her. It says, by dint of comparing her to his mother, he conceived a great admiration for her. Then he wished to possess her, to be her lord and master, to marry her. I thought that was interesting. He could have fallen in love with anybody, but this woman reminded him of his mother. Mm-hmm. Probably he was dominated by his mother, so he wants to reverse that. Mm-hmm. That was an interesting bit of psychology from Farnsworth.
The creepy thing about this is that Jack acted like he liked them, that they were all friends. He was a great friend to them in every respect. He spent way more than he could afford on their wedding present. He was fun to hang out with, but he harbored this secret hatred and waited to serve his revenge as a very, very cold lunch.
The coldest of lunches. He's being friendly to them just to make his revenge even sweeter. This was so great because that's like an Iago-like setup or any psychological thriller kind of thing where the character is this evil force that's going to worm his way into their life by being a friend, but slowly, meticulously picking everything apart. And yet from the last story, I knew this was going to be dumb. So this kind of setup should mean that by the end, you know, the husband's going to be accused of rape from his secretary and his business is destroyed and he's in prison and she's probably got relatives that hate her and, you know, a whole revenge plan that we get to watch unfold. And instead, I knew it was going to just be something ridiculous. So great setup for me. I was very excited.
Ellen and Marjorie moved to California. Jack bid them fond farewell, and he told her to write, and she did.
She's fallen for his fake friendship. It says, Marjorie was fond of the handsome, manly-looking Italian youth and liked him immensely as a friend, although she had never been in love with him.
In the letter, she talks about how there are all these rattlesnakes around, and she hates them.
You would like the country better than I do, for it is infested with rattlesnakes. The bare desert rocks on the ridge 4 miles from our cabin are swarming with them. they sun themselves in tangled masses.
Now, this gives Jack an idea. He writes her and he explains he wants to do a monograph on rattlesnakes. So he's going to move to California to be near them.
He didn't write to let them know. He just showed up. They made a note of that.
Oh,
they
missed that.
That's a powerful move. They're a little surprised, but he says, this isn't a pleasure trip, although I expect to have pleasure enough of it before I get through. So he says, I've turned from collecting reptiles to studying their lives and habits. Clearly, he's not actually doing that, as we will discover. But he writes, when I got your letter, Marjorie, I knew that I could do no better than to come here. Well, don't bring any of your snakes around here. I turn cold and sometimes grip at my insides every time I hear one rattle. What do you say to two rattles? He says. Oh no, the joke is back. I said it was dead and it's back. It's a ghost joke.
Why won't you die? Crimey has a shack built for him to live in and he begins his research, all the while just waiting for an opportunity.
This plan, it was set up like it was going to be calculated, but it's so clumsy. And from the outside, it's like, this guy loves snakes. Through a random coincidence, she moves to Snake Valley. And then he thinks, now's the time for my revenge. So this wasn't exactly a hop frog level thing. He just kind of went, I'm going to wait around till an opportunity presents itself.
What if she and Alan moved away to a place where there were no snakes?
That's what I thought, too. Or what if they moved to Europe and it was just outside of his means to pursue them? I'm like, this whole waiting for an opportunity plan wasn't very good.
Yeah, this is really... I think he's probably really lazy about his plan. Like, he goes, oh, someday. And then eventually he'll be, like, 90. And then he'll be at one of their funerals and just like, oh, he would visit them often and got to know some of the other people that worked with Alan. They would play cards together. It's so creepy how they really like and love Jack, and he is happy to see them, genuinely happy, but his joy comes from the idea of murdering them.
Hey, enjoy life on your terms, you know?
Finally, an opportunity presents itself. A drunk cook gets fired by Alan, and he says, you and the Italian wife of yours will see plenty of snakes, red and green and all that stuff. And Jack thinks, oh, this is perfect. I can use rattlesnakes to kill both of them, and this drunk cook will get the blame. This is perfect.
Girl I want revenge on moves to Snake Valley, and then somebody threatens them with snakes. As long as those things fall into place, my plan will work excellently.
It's gonna all pull together.
This is the thing that's awesome. The snakes sunning themselves out on the ridge, as she described, just urban legend, as he discovers. He goes, there's plenty of snakes around, but they don't ride out in a mass like that. So one would think he'd go, what else do people say about snakes that might not be true?
No, he doesn't.
He does not pursue that line of questioning. No. He gathers up tons of snakes in boxes, and then he sneaks into the settlement where the couple's living, because there's like engineers around huts, and it's kind of gonna ooze like setup. And then the revenge plan begins. He nails fast the windows of the cabin, because they're not there. He secures the bed to the floor so it can't be moved. That made me laugh. Who escapes snakes by scooting their bed? I don't know why he had to do that. So then he laboriously carries his boxes of snakes a mile or more to the little gully behind the surveyor's cabins, and he hides them because he's going to drop mid later. So I'm so mad that Farnsworth didn't put a scene in here with two wacky prospectors who get in a fight about whether the sagebrush is hissing or not. I mean, it's right there. There are boxes of snakes in the bushes. That's like Three Stooges fuel.
Yeah.
So the couple come home all tired from doing whatever they were doing. They hit the hay in their nailed up house. This is very realistic. When people are in the Southwest, they never open windows.
No.
This is something they wouldn't discover at all. They go right to bed.
And he goes in. They were fast in their chains of slumber, and he did not even find it necessary to muffle his tread. He removed the chairs, shoes, clothes, and even the hand mirror and toilet articles. Everything that might serve as a weapon, no matter how slight, he took away.
That means earlier, he made a mental map of all of the stuff in the cottage and then memorized where it was at and how it could be used in a snake fight. So he went, that toilet brush doesn't look lethal, but if he rammed it in there. So he for a long time stood in there just studying, thinking about snake fighting.
He then dumps this huge pile of rattlesnakes on their bed, leaves and locks the door from the outside, and then he just goes home. He's sure that they're going to be dead soon, so he's just going to delight in this moment of joy. His revenge is finally being served.
That he's not going to witness. Step four is dump a pile of snakes on them, and they're so tired they don't wake up. That's step four of the plan.
Well, they make it through the night undisturbed. It isn't until Marjorie wakes up that she finds a snake curled up to her that she flips out.
It's creeping along her breast when she wakes up. So Farnsworth may not be a good writer, but he does know what the public wants. He's seen enough episodes of Manimal to know if you show a snake in the first act, it's got to be crawling on a breast in the third act.
Her shriek rent the air as she threw back the bedclothes and sprang to the floor. She stepped on a coiled serpent, which sounded an ominous warning as it struck out blindly. She quickly climbed back on the bed and stood on the pillow, screaming. Her husband was beside her at once. For an instant, he thought she must be in the clutch of some horrible nightmare. Then, a quick, startled glance around the room turned his blood to ice. There was a continuous rattling, as of dry leaves blowing against a stone wall. The room was filled with their angry din. It sounded in Jimerson's ears like the crack of doom. The floor seemed covered with the creeping reptiles. Some were coiled, the whirring tips of their tails making an indistinct blur as they rattled, and their heads swaying slowly back and forth. Others writhed along the floor, their venomous squat heads thrusting forward and withdrawing, and their tongues darting out like red flames. Jimerson attacked the reptile with a pillow, sweeping it from the bed onto the floor. He quickly looked about him for a weapon and saw at once that he was trapped. There was not even a shoe or a pincushion with which to fight the crawling, rattling creatures. He sprang to the window and felt a sharp stab of pain in the flesh of his calf as the open jaws of another reptile found their mark, and the poison fangs were embedded deep in the flesh. The window, like the door, was nailed fast, but he broke out the glass with his bare fists. Unmindful of the blood on his lacerated hands, he was back at the bedside, treading over the reptiles with his bare feet. He lifted her in his bleeding arms and hurled her through the window to safety.
The great thing about this was I missed the detail. This is my fault, but I missed the detail where he broke all the glass with his hand. So in this action scene, he just fully picked his wife up and just threw her through the window to get her safe from the snakes. It was so absurd. I love this.
Unfortunately, he cuts his thigh on some broken glass that's still in the window frame on his way out, and he passes out from the bites and the blood loss.
But so I made fun of that plan, but it looks like it worked, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah, there you go. Back in his cabin, Jack is just happy as a clam. So much joy about these people dying, finally getting his revenge, fantasizing about their brutal deaths, how they met their ends.
Yeah, because you spend so much time fantasizing about what's going to happen that when it actually goes down, what you want to do is continue fantasizing about it. I think that a lot of people who construct elaborate revenge plans and uproot their entire lives to execute them, they don't need to be there to witness the revenge. You know, it's that old phrase, the criminal never visits the scene of the crime. That is the most preposterous part of the story.
That never happens, yeah.
This guy would be in the attic with a hole cut out, masturbating furiously while the snakes attack them. That is what would happen.
Of course. Now, even though he is an expert about snakes, there is one very important fact that has eluded Jack. Rattlesnake bites aren't usually fatal.
Say what?
If you've ever been bitten by a rattlesnake, this is what you do. Don't raise the area above the level of your heart. If you do, the blood containing the rattlesnake venom will reach your heart more quickly.
So don't dance the poison away.
No.
As you can dance so many other things away.
Stay as still as possible, as movement will increase the blood flow and the venom will circulate faster. Remove any tight clothing or jewelry before you start to swell. Let the wound bleed, as it might allow some of the venom to be released.
I think Trent Reznor wrote that last bullet point there. Let the wound bleed. Allow the venom to release.
Don't wash the wound, as your medical team may be able to use some of the venom from your skin to more quickly identify the correct antivenom.
That's cool.
Place a clean bandage around the wound. Try to remain calm, as anxiety and panic increase the heart rate, which will increase the venom to spread.
This made me think of a good scheme, because there's so many mindfulness, like anti-anxiety classes out there. Think about this.
Okay.
Look at all the stuff you have to do to stay safe. So if I have a rattlesnake, I bite you, I'll be like, if you don't calm down, you're going to die. So you better learn to do it right now. Like in the next 20 minutes.
There you go. Yeah. If you begin to experience signs of shock, try to lie down on your back, raise your feet slightly, keep warm, don't cut the wound as this doesn't help, and you could cause an infection. Don't try to suck out the venom from the wound. That's an old wives' tale, that whole thing. As you then introduce the venom to your mouth, as well as introduce the bacteria from your mouth to the wound, and don't use a tourniquet or apply ice or water. You'll start to feel the effects of the bite in moments, but it usually takes a couple of days for it to be life-threatening if you don't get medical aid. A couple days. So guess what? Alan and Marjorie, they're fine. He's messed up more from his cut, on the glass getting out of the window, but they're okay.
I don't think he even visited a doctor. No. Because they've been living around here, and without even studying snakes, he just picked up on this.
Yeah.
Rested, let the poison wash out. His wrist is a little swollen. That's it.
And I'm sure they have rattlesnake antivenom around because there's so many rattlesnakes around there.
Yeah.
No big whoop. A few days later, they go and visit Jack. Jack Crimey is working on writing some stuff, whatever. He's sitting at his desk. He's happy as a clam. He's killed these two people, but he's got the spring in his step. He's just loving life right now.
He was feasting on the mental and physical tortures that Jimerson and Marjorie must have endured before they lay cold in death on the floor of the cabin, hideously discolored by the venom of the rattlesnakes. Again, imagining it. No interest in seeing it.
He's so happy about this that he doesn't even hear the knock of the cabin door. When somebody enters, he figures it's someone to finally tell him that they have died.
Two persons stood before him, and he raised his eyes in eager anticipation to feed his revengeful spirit on the story he had waited 2 days to hear. Even when he gazed on those whom he had consigned to a horrible death, the thought that they were alive did not penetrate his consciousness. The idea of failure had never entered his mind, even for an instant. They were dead, beyond the peradventure of a doubt, and now their avenging ghosts stood before him. Crimey dropped to his knees in white terror and crawled behind his chair. He clasped and unclasped his hands in agony of fear. Sweat poured from his face and bathed his body. He implored mercy. He screamed for forgiveness. He gibbered like a frightened ape. Half-forgotten words of Italian learned at his mother's knee fell from his lips. He pleaded and begged for his life, crawling on his face toward the amazed couple in an endeavor to clasp their knees. As the meaning of his broken ejaculations was borne on them, a tremendous loathing and disgust overcame them. Crimey shrieked and gnawed his hand as he saw the avenging angels of his victims leave the cabin. It was impossible for the stern hand of the law to inflict a greater punishment on Jack Crimey than his own malice had wrought for him. Today, he occupies a padded cell in a hospital for the incurably insane.
Oh boy. Why did he think they were ghosts? He didn't even have them walk through a clothesline and get covered with sheets or they fell into some funny powder or something. No. They just showed up.
Yeah.
Because I think it says, didn't they? They dragged themselves over to the house. So there was evidence of their snake bites on them, like a swollen wrist. And he just immediately went, oh my God, they're ghosts. And it scared him so bad he's in an insane asylum instead of jail.
Yeah, this is the kind of material that was submitted into Weird Tales, issues 1 and 2.
That might be one of the best endings for a story ever. Did I write this? It's so funny to me that somebody would just see somebody who was injured and go, that's a ghost. If I went to a funeral, I went to the open casket visitation and I looked down at somebody and saw they were dead. And then a couple of days later, they showed up at my house. I would think, I made a mistake. We made a mistake. That person is alive. They're physically here. For a ghost, they would have to be levitating, made of ectoplasm.
Transparent. Yeah, it's preposterous. And I'm glad Farnsworth found his groove being an editor.
When I do want to say this, though.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw Norman Lloyd macking on those tacos with the mustache on, there was a split second. Is that a ghost? No, it's a scheme. It's a scheme. Okay. It's not a scheme. That's another 106-year-old man.
Yes.
But I'm just saying I had that thought.
Yeah, of course you did. I want to thank our reader, Ryan Negron. Thank you so much for your reading. You are really talented and a champ. If anybody out there is looking for a great actor that sounds just like Ryan, we'll put links to where you can find him in the show notes.
Great addition to the show, and we're glad to have you, Ryan. And I also would like to thank some patrons, and I'm going to start by thanking Anthony Lopez. Is that our friend Tony Lopez? Trying to trick us by using Anthony? I know who you are.
Antonio Lopez. I'd like to thank Cameron Mills.
I'd like to thank Ryan McLean.
And I'd like to thank Daniel Alm.
George, thank you.
Hey, Herbert Britt III, thank you.
I'd like to thank the first two as well, and also thank Bluebird.
I'd like to thank Louis Alberto Pastor.
I'd like to thank Andrew.
Sydney Duda, thank you so much for your support.
That wraps up Monster Making July. Actually, Farnsworth tried to make some monsters in here, but it turned out it was just a dead sister. So somewhat on theme. We're going to be back in August. We're actually going to do The Sandman by E.T.A. Hoffman, which folks have been asking for a while. That's going to be fun stuff. So I hope you all are looking forward to that, and we'll be with you then. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackin. You've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Here on hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.